You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. Chinese threat group APT-10 seems to have been busy lately and up to its familiar industrial espionage. More governments express skepticism about Chinese manufacturers. The U.S. report on election security is out. Influence ops were found to have had no material effect on the midterms. Lithuania worries about Russian election meddling. A reverse RDP attack risk is reported. There's an industrial IoT remote code flaw. And congratulations to the finalists in RSA's Innovation Sandbox. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Wednesday, February 6th, 2019. The cyber incident Airbus disclosed on January 30th is now believed to have been the work of Chinese operators. So says French publication Challenges, citing anonymous sources close to the investigation. Signs seem to point to APT-10, also known as Stone Panda or Menu Pass. APT-10 is generally associated with the Tianjin Bureau of Ministry State Security. Airbus made its disclosure within GDPR's prescribed 72 hours, since the hackers accessed employee data, mostly professional contact and IT identification details. APT-10 has been busy elsewhere, too. A report by Recorded Future and Rapid7 concludes in a cautionary account of third-party risk that the espionage group has been active against managed service provider Visma, a U.S. law firm with a wide-ranging intellectual property practice, and other companies. Here, there's less uncertainty about attribution, and there seems little doubt that the campaigns were the work of APT-10. The mode of approach is interesting. The attackers gained access to their targets using valid but stolen user credentials for Citrix remote access tools. From there, they conducted privilege escalation and used DLL sideloading to install a malicious DLL that decrypted and injected Trochilus malware as its payload. The attackers also, in at least two of the cases, introduced an uppercut backdoor into its targets by using the Notepad++ updater, and again, sideloading malicious DLL. These are all techniques APT-10 has used before. Its malware also used Dropbox to exfiltrate stolen data. APT-10 began deploying its current version of Trochilus at the end of last August. Rapid7, which participated in the investigation with Recorded Future, followed the Dropbox trail to operations against the targeted law firm back in 2017. Where's the third-party risk? It's in the data APT-10 exfiltrated, which in principle makes it possible for them to gain access to many companies and organizations the initial targets dealt with. Supply chains and business relationships generally are sufficiently complex and intertwined to make this sort of threat commonplace. MSPs and cloud providers will continue to be particularly attractive targets, especially for nation-state espionage services. Recorded Future and Rapid7 see their investigation as corroborating the widespread suspicion among Five Eyes intelligence and law enforcement services that Chinese industrial espionage remains very much an ongoing and growing threat. Chinese industrial policy and espionage were the cyber-related matters that figured in U.S. President Trump's recent State of the Union address. Apart from that address, the U.S. continues to warn its allies, particularly its European allies, about the risks of giving Chinese firms a prominent role in their communications and IT infrastructure. Most of these strictures have fallen on Huawei, but the smaller ZTE is also coming in for scrutiny. A number of countries seem to need little, if any, U.S. tutorials to be wary of Chinese firms. Norway has expressed official reservations about Huawei this week, and the Czech Republic's cybersecurity officials have said they doubt that either Huawei or ZTE will be permitted a foothold in that country's infrastructure. Here's a trivia question for you. What was the first organization to register a domain name as a .org? It was in 1985, and it was not-for-profit MITRE Corporation. These days, MITRE continues their online trailblazing, not the least of which is the MITRE Attack Knowledge Base of Adversary Tactics and Techniques, based on real-world observations. Katie Nichols is Attack Threat Intelligence Lead at MITRE Corporation.
It came out of a project called the Fort Meade Experiment at MITRE, where there was a series of red team, blue team exercises. So the red team would come in, compromise the network, do their thing. And they found in trying to communicate back to the blue team that something like Lockheed Martin kill chain wasn't quite granular enough for them to communicate exactly what they did. So Attack was born out of that. And in 2015, MITRE publicly released Attack. And since then, kind of the growth has been sort of explosive, especially in the past year or so. We've heard from so many people who've said that Attack's really useful for them to do everything from write better detections, to track threat intelligence about adversaries, to doing red teaming like the MITRE team used to do. So sort of what it is, a knowledge base of what adversaries can do and their tactics, techniques, and procedures. One of the cool things is because it's open to anyone, we see vendors map their products to it. We also see people learn from it, like a student could go in and learn the different things adversaries are doing, or security operations centers can go in and map to it as well. So because it's open, you know, we want everyone in the community to use it. And so the benefit to us is really the benefit back to the community.
Yeah, it seems as though there's really something for everyone here, even from, as you said, you know, folks who are just starting out. This is a great place to kind of get the lay of the land. But also for those people who are more advanced, there's plenty of information that they could benefit from as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We've heard that time and time again. You know, people who are just starting out are really overwhelmed because it's hundreds of techniques to look into. But we've heard from companies who've done things like every week, choose a single technique, right, and have a deep dive on that. How do we detect against it? How do we understand it? To more sophisticated organizations, we're looking across, you know, enterprise attack, which is 224 techniques, looking at each of those and how they detect those and doing kind of an overall assessment of their coverage and their defenses. So lots of different levels. But we hope that it's, you know, a pretty low barrier just to get started with attack.
And what are your recommendations for people to get started? How, if someone isn't familiar with it or wants to find out more, figure out how they can integrate it into their own workflow, what's the best way to go at that?
Sure. So there are a lot of different approaches. My background's in threat intelligence, so of course I'm going to say look at your adversaries, right? On our website, we have a bunch of different threat groups, and we've mapped those behaviors from open source public reporting to attack. So you can go in there and say, okay, if I care about APT-10 or APT-29 or some other threat group, what are the techniques that those adversaries are using? And from there, you know, narrow it down from hundreds of techniques to just that handful of what do I know that these adversaries that I care about are doing, and then kind of looking at how you can detect and mitigate against those. And we have some ideas for getting started with detection mitigation on our website. So pick a group we have, or map your own group based on your own threat intel and start from there. I love that threat-informed defense approach. One question we get asked a lot is sort of what's next for the team. And based on feedback, one area that we're looking to create is a new tactic for impacts, which we think of things like data manipulation or destruction, because that's been a gap in the framework. Also looking at structuring our mitigations. We have, you know, ideas for mitigations, but trying to structure those in a way to help people figure out, if I use this one mitigation, what techniques can I wipe out? And looking at also sub-techniques. For some people, level of granularity isn't quite deep enough in the existing attack techniques we have, and we've heard that. So we're trying to figure out how do we go to that next level of detail.
That's Katie Nichols from MITRE. You can check out MITRE Attack at attack.mitre.org. The U.S. Departments of Homeland Security and Justice have issued their congressionally mandated report on whether there was foreign meddling in the 2018 midterm elections. The departments found no evidence of any foreign activity that had any material impact on the elections or the infrastructure surrounding them. The report isn't naive about the extent of influence operations, which the U.S. intelligence community as a whole has been pretty clear about. They're an ongoing threat. The conclusion is that the operations had no material effect on the elections or the campaigns surrounding those elections. Turning to the Baltic states, Vilnius thinks, according to Reuters, that Russia is preparing information operations to interfere with Lithuanian elections. Russia says the fears are nonsense because they'd never do something like that, holding, as Moscow always has, that the internal affairs of other countries are sacred. We're kidding about the second part. Nobody, least of all Moscow, has ever really thought it a duty to mind their own business with respect to other countries' family affairs. About calling the fears ridiculous and saying they'd never do that? Oh, the Russian government spokesman did say all that. The U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce wants Apple to explain why it took so long to patch FaceTime, which suggests that this story at least will have longer legs than Apple would no doubt have preferred. Researchers at security firm Checkpoint Research have discovered more reasons for concern about the Remote Desktop Protocol, or RDP. In this case, the newish wrinkle is the possibility of a reverse RDP attack in which an attacker could, as Checkpoint expresses it, reverse the usual direction of communication and infect the IT professional or security researcher's computer. Doing this would enable compromise of a network as a whole. One of the more interesting things they found was that a clipboard sharing channel between client and server could be abused by attackers. Checkpoint has told Microsoft about the issue, but Redmond, Checkpoint says, acknowledged the validity of their findings but said they weren't serious enough to service. So, Checkpoint recommends patch your RDP clients and disable the clipboard sharing channel. That channel, they note, is on by default. So if you've never realized it's there, well, apparently it not only is, but it's on, too. With respect to the industrial Internet of Things, security firm Tenable disclosed today that it had found a remote code execution vulnerability in the widely used Indusoft Web Studio product. Tenable describes Web Studio as an automation tool for human-machine interface and supervisory control and data acquisition, that is, SCADA systems. So, if you're a Web Studio user, and if you run a manufacturing plant, an oil and gas production or distribution facility, a city's water supply, a jail, a prison, or even a drag racer, then Tenable recommends you update your software and make sure it's not accessible from the Internet. And finally, RSA has announced the finalists for the Innovation Sandbox at next month's RSA conference. It's a highly coveted honor to be selected as a finalist, so congratulations to them all. They include Arcos Labs and its frictionless fraud detection, cybersecurity asset management platform provider Axonius, Capsule 8 with its real-time zero-day exploit detection offering, identity and privileged access management provider CloudNox Security, cloud infrastructure control shop DisruptOps Inc., Duality Technologies and its advanced data privacy solution, Eclipsium Inc., which offers firmware and hardware defense, API Defender Salt Security, Shift Left, Inc., which offers a fresh approach to application security, and privacy management firm Wirewheel. Congratulations to all, and we look forward to seeing them in San Francisco on March 4th. And joining me once again is Emily Wilson. She's the VP of Research at Terbium Labs. Emily, it's great to have you back. I wanted to touch today about biometrics and what you are seeing in terms of this information showing up on the dark web. Why don't we start off, what are we talking about when we're saying biometrics?
When we think about biometrics, we can think about a few different things. It could be things like facial recognition technology, the things that Apple would use for Face ID, or the technology that's being used in China, you know, to track individuals. We could be thinking about fingerprints, what we use to unlock our iPhones, for example. We could be thinking about voice recognition, or more and more now, genetic data. We think about these companies like Ancestry.com or 23andMe, who are offering genetic testing services. That information's now in the system, and that would definitely qualify.
And so are these things showing up for trade in dark web markets?
It's kind of a two-part answer. No, not really. Not yet. So the no, not really, no, we're not seeing this show up right now. But the not yet bit is the more interesting side of this. I think we will see it. And here's why. It is a new type of data that we're seeing collected more broadly. Apple's been using it for ages. Again, you know, some state systems use this. We're going to see it used more and more for identification and authentication, because it's sort of a two-factor that we think other people couldn't force right now. It's something that you are. You know, no one else right now is in a position to forge your fingerprint at scale. And so it's a safe way to unlock your phone. As more and more technologies start to use this kind of data, it's going to be more appealing to cyber criminals. We're not there yet, though. And that's the piece of this. You know, I've been getting a lot of questions about this lately. People are genuinely concerned about whether or not this is being traded. But if we stop for a minute and think about how cyber criminals would use this, if you had fingerprint data for five random people, not five high-profile individuals, not five people with clearance, just five random people, what would you do with it? How would you monetize it? Right now, it's not the most effective way. Right now, it's not a blocker for any cyber criminal who's looking to profit. And so it's not being traded yet.
And of course, I suppose one of the risks we hear about with biometrics is that it's not like a password where you can just change it.
It's definitely, it falls in the category of lifetime data. You know, the same way that we think about socials as being effectively immutable, or names, right? A lot of people, no one's going to change their name because of a data breach. You know, we're not kind of going into a full witness protection mode for everyone who's had data compromise. But when it comes to biometrics, then it becomes a lot more difficult and a lot more sensitive. You know, one of the things people worry about with health records could be family history, or, you know, questions about lineage, or questions about disease or mental health. Once we start getting into genuine biometric data, then that kind of blows that even more out of proportion.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to ponder even the possibility of ransomware situations, of someone saying, hey, I have your biometric data here. It'd be a shame if anyone were to find out about your family history of mental illness or something like that.
Which is unfortunate for any number of reasons, right? That there's a stigma around that, or it would be unfortunately an effective thing to do, especially if you start thinking about high-profile individuals, if you think about an extension of doxing, or if you think about state officials, for example. The other thing we have to worry about, and this is a kind of a slight side note on it, but not just data compromise, but data integrity. When we talk about going in and changing hospital records, you know, this kind of information also has the potential to be useful there. There are also the questions of, if for some reason all of the fingerprint data that Apple currently has theoretically, hypothetically available, what if all of a sudden that was available to law enforcement? You know, we're looking at a lot of questions now about the legality of unlocking phones, or, you know, preserving or destroying data. In a hypothetical world where this information is all being stored, or facial recognition technology is being stored, and you didn't have to circumvent it by forcing someone to unlock a phone or using a mask to beat the face technology, if that data was just available, you know, then we start getting into sci-fi movies of the future. And we're certainly not there yet, but it is something to be concerned about going forward because the data is being collected. And at some point, it will become appealing and potentially necessary for cyber criminals. But I think we're still a good 10 years out from that being a real issue.
Hmm. All right, Emily Wilson, thanks for joining us.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the dark net, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.